all done with, completely. I even managed to eat a little dinner that night and pretend to take part in the jawing at the table. Another thing about administrative punishment. There is no permanent black mark. Those records are destroyed at the end of boot training, and you start clean. The only record is one where it counts most. You don't forget it. 8. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Proverbs 22:6. There were other floggings, but darn few. Hendrick was the only man in our regiment to be flogged by sentence of court-martial. The others were administrative punishment, like mine. And for lashes, it was necessary to go all the way up to the regimental commander, which a subordinate commander finds distasteful. To put it faintly. Even then, Major Malloy was much more likely to kick the man out, undesirable discharge, than to have the whipping post erected. In a way, an administrative flogging is the mildest sort of a compliment. It means that your supervisors think that there is a faint possibility that you just might have the character eventually to make a soldier and a citizen, unlikely as it seems at the moment. I was the only one to get the maximum administrative punishment. None of the others got more than 3 lashes. Nobody else came as close as I did to putting on civilian clothes, but I still squeaked by. This is a social distinction of sorts. I don't recommend it. But we had another case, much worse than mine or Ted Hendricks. A really sick-making one. Once, they erected gallows. Now look, get this straight. This case didn't really have anything to do with the Army. The crime didn't take place at Camp Curie, and the placement officer who accepted this boy for MI should turn in his suit. He deserted only 2 days after we arrived at Curie. Ridiculous, of course, but nothing about the case made sense. Why didn't he resign? Desertion, naturally, is one of the 31 crash landings. But the Army doesn't invoke the death penalty for it unless there are special circumstances, such as in the face of the enemy, or something else that turns it from a highly informal way of resigning into something that can't be ignored. The Army makes no effort to find deserters and bring them back. This makes the hardest kind of sense. We're all volunteers. We're MI because we want to be. We're proud to be MI, and MI is proud of us. If a man doesn't feel that way about it, from his calloused feet to his hairy ears, I don't want him on my flank when trouble starts. If I buy a piece of it, I want the men around me who will pick me up because they're MI, and I'm MI. And my skin means as much to them as their own. I don't want any ersatz soldiers dragging their tails and ducking out when the party gets rough. It's a whole lot safer to have a blank file on your flank than to have an alleged soldier who is nursing the conscript syndrome. So if they run, let them run. It's a waste of time and money to fetch them back. Of course, most of them do come back, though it may take them years, in which case the Army tiredly lets them have their 50 lashes instead of hanging them and turns them loose. I suppose it must wear on a man's nerves to be a fugitive, when everybody else is either a citizen or a legal resident, even when the police aren't trying to find him. The wicked flee when no man pursueth. The temptation to turn yourself in, take your lumps, and breathe easily again must get to be overpowering. But this boy didn't turn himself in. He was gone 4 months, and I doubt if his own company remembered him, since he had been with them only a couple of days. He was probably just a name without a face, the Dillinger, N.L., who had to be reported, day after day, as absent without leave on the morning muster. Then he killed a baby girl. He was tried and convicted by a local tribunal, but identity check showed that he was an undischarged soldier. The department had to be notified, and our commanding general at once intervened. He was returned to us, since military law and jurisdiction take precedence over civil code. Why did the general bother? Why didn't he let the local sheriff do the job? In order to teach us a lesson? Not at all. I'm quite sure that our general did not think that any of his boys needed to be nauseated in order not to kill any baby girls. By now, I believe that he would have spared us that sight, had it been possible. We did learn a lesson, though nobody mentioned it at the time, and it is one that takes a long time to sink in until it becomes second nature. The MI take care of their own, no matter what. Dillinger belonged to us. He was still on our rolls, even though we didn't want him, even though we should never have had him, even though we should have been happy to disclaim him. He was a member of our regiment. We couldn't brush him off and let a sheriff 1,000 miles away handle it. If it has to be done, a man, a real man, shoots his own dog himself. He doesn't hire a proxy who may bungle it. The regimental records said that Dillinger was ours, so taking care of him was our duty. That evening we marched to the parade grounds at slow march, 60 beats to the minute. Hard to keep step when you're used to 140, while the band played dirge for the unmourned. Then Dillinger was marched out, dressed in MI full dress just as we were, and the band played Danny Deaver, while they stripped off every trace of insignia, even buttons and cap, leaving him in a maroon and light blue suit that was no longer a uniform. The drums held a sustained roll, and it was all over. We passed in review, and on home at the fast trot. I didn't think anybody fainted, and I don't think anybody quite got sick, even though most of us didn't eat much dinner that night, and I've never heard the mess tent so quiet. But grisly as it was the first time I had seen death, first time for most of us. It was not the shock that Ted Hendricks' flogging was. I mean, you couldn't put yourself in Dillinger's place. You didn't have any feeling of, it could have been me. Not counting the technical matter of desertion, Dillinger had committed at least 4 capital crimes. If his victim had lived, he still would have danced Danny Deaver for any one of the other 3. Kidnapping, demand of ransom, criminal neglect, etc. I had no sympathy for him and still haven't. That old saw that to understand all is to forgive all is a lot of tripe. Some things, the more you understand, the more you loathe them. My sympathy is reserved for Barbara Ann Enthwaite, whom I had never seen, and for her parents, who would never again see their little girl. As the band put away their instruments that night, we started 30 days of mourning for Barbara, and of disgrace for us. With our colors draped in black, no music at parade, no singing on route march. Only once did I hear anybody complain, and another boot promptly asked him how he would like a full set of lumps. Certainly it hadn't been our fault, but our business was to guard little girls, not kill them. Our regiment had been dishonored. We had to clean it. We were disgraced, and we felt disgraced. That night I tried to figure out how such things could be kept from happening. Of course, they hardly ever do nowadays, but even once is way too many. I never did reach any answer that satisfied me. This Dillinger, he looked like anybody else, and his behavior and record couldn't have been too odd, or he would never have reached Camp Curie in the first place. I suppose he was one of those pathological personalities you read about. No way to spot them. Well, if there was no way to keep it from happening once, there was only one sure way to keep it from happening twice, which we had used. If Dillinger had understood what he was doing, which seems credible, then he got what was coming to him, except that it seemed a shame that he hadn't suffered as much as had little Barbara Ann. He practically hadn't suffered at all. But suppose, as seemed more likely, he was so crazy that he had never been aware that he was doing anything wrong, What then?
Well, we shoot mad dogs, don't we?
Yes, but being crazy that way is a sickness. I couldn't see but two possibilities. Either he couldn't be made well, in which case he was better off dead for his own sake and for the safety of others, or he could be treated and made sane, in which case, it seemed to me, if he ever became sane enough for civilized society and thought over what he had done while he was sick, what could be left for him but suicide? How could he live with himself? And suppose he escaped before he was cured and did the same thing again, and maybe again. How do you explain that to bereaved parents, in view of his record? I couldn't see but one answer. I found myself mulling over a discussion in our class in history and moral philosophy. Mr. Dubois was talking about the disorders that preceded the breakup of the North American Republic back in the 20th century. According to him, there was a time just before they went down the drain when such crimes as Dillinger's were as common as dogfights. The terror had not been just in North America. Russia and the British Isles had it too, as well as other places. But it reached its peak in North America shortly before things went to pieces. Law-abiding people, Dubois told us, hardly dared go into a public park at night. To do so was to risk attack by wolf packs of children, armed with chains, knives, homemade guns, bludgeons. To be hurt at least, robbed most certainly, injured for life probably, or even killed. This went on for years, right up to the war between the Russo-Anglo-American alliance and the Chinese hegemony. Murder, drug addiction, larceny, assault, and vandalism were commonplace. Nor were parks the only places. These things happened also on the streets in daylight, on school grounds, even inside school buildings. But parks were so notoriously unsafe that honest people stayed clear of them after dark. I had tried to imagine such things happening in our schools. I simply couldn't. Nor in our parks. A park was a place for fun, not for getting hurt. As for getting killed in one, Mr. Dubois, didn't they have police or courts? They had many more police than we have, and more courts, all overworked. I guess I don't get it. If a boy in our city had done anything half that bad, well, he and his father would have been flogged side by side. But such things just didn't happen. Mr. Dubois then demanded of me, define a juvenile delinquent. One of those kids, the ones who used to beat up people.
Wrong.
Huh? But the book said... My apologies. Your textbook does so state. But calling a tail a leg does not make the name fit. Juvenile delinquent is a contradiction in terms, one which gives a clue to their problem and their failure to solve it. Have you ever raised a puppy?
Yes, sir.
Did you housebreak him?
Yes, sir, eventually.
It was my slowness in this that caused my mother to rule that dogs must stay out of the house.
Ah, yes. When your puppy made mistakes, were you angry?
What?
Why, he didn't know any better. He was just a puppy.
What did you do?
Why, I scolded him and rubbed his nose in it and paddled him.
Surely he could not understand your words.
No, but he could tell I was sore at him.
But you just said that you were not angry.
Mr. Dubois had an infuriating way of getting a person mixed up.
No, but I had to make him think I was. He had to learn, didn't he?
Conceded.
But, having made it clear to him that you disapproved, how could you be so cruel as to spank him as well? You said the poor beastie didn't know that he was doing wrong, yet you inflicted pain. Justify yourself. Or are you a sadist?
I didn't then know what a sadist was, but I knew pups.
Mr. Dubois, you have to. You scold him so that he knows he's in trouble. You rub his nose in it so that he will know what trouble you mean. You paddle him so that he darn well won't do it again. And you have to do it right away. It doesn't do a bit of good to punish him later. You'll just confuse him.
Even so, he won't learn from one lesson, so you watch, and you catch him again and paddle him still harder. Pretty soon he learns, but it's a waste of breath just to scold him. Then I added, I guess you've never raised pups. Many. I'm raising a dachshund now, by your methods. Let's get back to those juvenile crimes. The most vicious averaged somewhat younger than you here in this class, and they often started their lawless careers much younger. Let us never forget that puppy. These children were often caught. Police arrested batches each day. Were they scolded? Yes, often scathingly. Were their noses rubbed in it? Rarely. News organs and officials usually kept their names secret. In many places, the law so required for criminals under 18. Were they spanked? Indeed not. Many had never been spanked even as small children. There was a widespread belief that spanking, or any punishment involving pain, did a child permanent psychic damage. I had reflected that my father must have never heard of that theory. Corporal punishment in schools was forbidden by law, he had gone on. Flogging was lawful as sentence of court only in one small province, Delaware, and there only for a few crimes and was rarely invoked. It was regarded as cruel and unusual punishment. Dubois had mused aloud. I don't understand objections to cruel and unusual punishment. While a judge should be benevolent in purpose, his awards should cause the criminal to suffer, else there is no punishment. And pain is the basic mechanism built into us by millions of years of evolution, which safeguards us by warning when something threatens our survival. Why should society refuse to use such a highly perfected survival mechanism? However, that period was loaded with pre-scientific, pseudo-psychological nonsense. As for unusual, punishment must be unusual or it serves no purpose. And then he pointed his stump at another boy. What would happen if a puppy were spanked every hour? Probably drive him crazy. Probably. It certainly would not teach him anything. How long has it been since the principal of this school last had to switch a pupil? I'm not sure. About 2 years? The kid that swiped, never mind. Long enough. It means that such punishment is so unusual as to be significant, to deter, to instruct. Back to these young criminals. They probably were not spanked as babies. They certainly were not flogged for their crimes. The usual sequence was, for a first offense, a warning, a scolding, often without trial. After several offenses, a sentence of confinement, but with sentence suspended, and the youngster placed on probation. A boy might be arrested many times and convicted several times before he was punished, and then it would be merely confinement, with others like him, from whom he learned still more criminal habits. If he kept out of major trouble while confined, he could usually evade most of even that mild punishment, be given probation, paroled in the jargon of the times. This incredible sequence could go on for years while his crimes increased in frequency and viciousness, with no punishment whatever, save rare, dull but comfortable confinements. Then suddenly, usually by law on his 18th birthday, this so-called juvenile delinquent becomes an adult criminal, and sometimes wound up in only weeks or months in a death cell, awaiting execution for murder. You. He had singled me out again. Suppose you merely scolded your puppy, never punished him, let him go on making messes in the house, and occasionally locked him up in the outbuilding, but soon let him back in the house with a warning not to do it again. Then one day you notice that he is now a grown dog and still not housebroken, whereupon you whip out a gun and shoot him dead. Comment, please. Why, that's the craziest way to raise a dog I ever heard of. I agree. Or a child. Whose fault would it be? Why, mine, I guess. Again, I agree.
but I'm not guessing.
Mr. Dubois, a girl blurted out. But why? Why didn't they spank those little kids when they needed it, and use a good dose of the strap on the older ones who deserved it? The sort of lesson they wouldn't forget. I mean, ones who did things really bad. Why not?
I don't know, he had answered grimly, except that the time-tested method of instilling social virtue and respect for law in the minds of the young did not appeal to the pre-scientific pseudo-professional class that called themselves social workers, or sometimes child psychologists. It was too simple for them, apparently, since anybody could do it, using only the patience and firmness needed in training a puppy. I have sometimes wondered if they cherished a vested interest in disorder, but that is unlikely. Adults almost always act from conscious, highest motives, no matter what their behavior.
But good heavens, the girl answered. I don't like being spanked any more than any kid does. But when I needed it, my mama delivered. The only time I ever got a switching in school, I got another one when I got home, and that was years and years ago. I don't ever expect to be hauled up in front of a judge and sentenced to a flogging. You behave yourself and such things don't happen. I don't see anything wrong with our system. It's a lot better than not being able to walk outdoors for fear of your life. Well, that's horrible.
I agree. Young lady, the tragic wrongness of what those well-meaning people did, contrasted with what they thought they were doing, goes very deep. They had no scientific theory of morals. They did have a theory of morals that they tried to live by. I should not have sneered at their motives. But their theory was wrong. Half of it, fuzzy-headed wishful thinking. Half of it, rationalized charlatanry. The more earnest they were, the farther it led them astray. You see, they assumed that man has a moral instinct.
Sir, I thought, but he does. I have.
No, my dear. You have a cultivated conscience, a most carefully trained one. Man has no moral instinct. He is not born with moral sense. You were not born with it. I was not born with it. And the puppy has none. We acquire moral sense, when we do, through training, experience, and hard sweat of the mind. These unfortunate juvenile criminals were born with none, even as you and I, and they had no chance to acquire any. Their experiences did not permit it. What is moral sense? It is an elaboration of the instinct to survive. The instinct to survive is human nature itself, and every aspect of our personalities derives from it. Anything that conflicts with the survival instinct acts, sooner or later, to eliminate the individual and thereby fails to show up in future generations. This truth is mathematically demonstrable, everywhere verifiable. It is the single eternal imperative controlling everything we do. But the instinct to survive, he had gone on, can be cultivated by motivations more subtle and much more complex than the blind, brute urge of the individual to stay alive. Young lady, what you miscall your moral instinct was the instilling in you by your elders of the truth that survival can have stronger imperatives than that of your own personal survival. Survival of your family, for example, of your children, when you have them, of your nation, if you struggle that high up the scale, and so on. A scientifically verifiable theory of morals must be rooted in the individual's instinct to survive, and nowhere else, and must correctly describe the hierarchy of survival, note the motivations at each level, and resolve all conflicts. We have such a theory now. We can solve any moral problem on any level. Self-interest, love of family, duty to country, responsibility toward the human race. We are even developing an exact ethic for extra-human relations. But all moral problems can be illustrated by one misquotation. Greater love hath no man than a mother cat dying to defend her kittens. Once you understand the problem facing that cat and how she solved it,
You will then be ready to examine yourself and learn how high up the moral ladder you are capable of climbing. These juvenile criminals hit a low level. Born with only the instinct for survival, the highest morality they achieved was a shaky loyalty to a peer group, a street gang. But the do-gooders attempted to appeal to their better natures, to reach them, to spark their moral sense. Tosh. They had no better natures. Experience taught them that what they were doing was the way to survive. The puppy never got his spanking. Therefore, what he did with pleasure and success must be moral. The basis of all morality is duty, a concept with the same relation to group that self-interest has to individual. Nobody preached duty to these kids in a way they could understand, that is, with a spanking. But the society they were in told them endlessly about their rights. The result should have been predictable, since a human being has no natural rights of any nature. Mr. Dubois paused. Somebody took the bait. Sir, how about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
Yes. The unalienable rights. Each year someone quotes that magnificent poetry.
Life? What right to life has a man who is drowning in the Pacific? The ocean will not hearken to his cries. What right to life has a man who must die if he is to save his children? If he chooses to save his own life, does he do so as a matter of right? If two men are starving and cannibalism is the only alternative to death, which man's right is unalienable? And is it right? As liberty, the heroes who signed the great document pledged themselves to buy liberty with their lives. Liberty is never unalienable. It must be redeemed regularly with the blood of patriots, or it always vanishes. Of all the so-called natural human rights that have ever been invented, liberty is the least likely to be cheap and is never free of cost. The third right, the pursuit of happiness, it is indeed unalienable, but it is not a right. It is simply a universal condition which tyrants cannot take away, nor patriots restore. Cast me into a dungeon, burn me at the stake, crown me king of kings. I can pursue happiness as long as my brain lives, but neither gods nor saints, wise men nor subtle drugs, can ensure that I will catch it. Mr. Dubois then turned to me. I told you that juvenile delinquent is a contradiction in terms. Delinquent means failing in duty, but duty is an adult virtue. Indeed, a juvenile becomes an adult when, and only when, he acquires a knowledge of duty and embraces it as dearer than the self-love he was born with. There never was, there cannot be, a juvenile delinquent. But for every juvenile criminal, there are always one or more adult delinquents, people of mature years who either do not know their duty or who, knowing it, fail. And that was the soft spot which destroyed what was, in many ways, an admirable culture. The junior hoodlums who roamed their streets were symptoms of a greater sickness. These citizens, all of them counted as such, glorified their mythology of rights and lost track of their duties. No nation, so constituted, can endure. I wonder how Colonel Dubois would have classed Dillinger. Was he a juvenile criminal who merited pity, even though you had to get rid of him? Or was he an adult delinquent who deserved nothing but contempt? I didn't know. I would never know. The one thing I was sure of was that he would never again kill any little girls. That suited me. I went to sleep. 9. We've got no place in this outfit for good losers. We want tough hombres who will go in there and win.
Admiral Jonas Ingram, 1926. When we had done all that a mudfoot can do in flat country, we moved into some rough mountains to do still rougher things. The Canadian Rockies between Good Hope Mountain and Mount Waddington. Camp Sergeant Spooky Smith was much like Camp Curie, aside from its rugged setting, but it was much smaller. Well, the 3rd Regiment was much smaller now, too. Less than 400, whereas we had started out with more than 2,000. H Company was now organized as a single platoon, and the battalion paraded as if it were a company. But we were still called H Company, and Zim was company commander, not platoon leader. What the sweatdown meant, really, was much more personal instruction. We had more corporal instructors than we had squads, and Sergeant Zim, with only 50 men on his mind instead of the 260 he had started with, kept his Argus eye on each one of us all the time. Even when he wasn't there. At least, if you goofed, it turned out he was standing right behind you. However, the chewing out you got had almost a friendly quality, in a horrid sort of way. Because we had changed too, as well as the regiment. The 1 in 5 who was left was almost a soldier, and Zim seemed to be trying to make him into one instead of running him over the hill. We saw a lot more of Captain Frankel, too. He now spent most of his time teaching us, instead of behind a desk, and he knew all of us by name and face, and seemed to have a card file in his mind of exactly what progress each man had made on every weapon, every piece of equipment, not to mention your extra duty status, medical record, and whether you had had a letter from home lately. He wasn't as severe with us as Zim was. His words were milder, and it took a really stupid stunt to take that friendly grin off his face. But don't let that fool you. There was barrel armor under the grin. I never did figure out which one was the better soldier, Zim or Captain Frankel. I mean, if you took away the insignia and thought of them as privates. Unquestionably, they were both better soldiers than any of the other instructors. But which was the best? Zim did everything with precision and style, as if he were on parade. Captain Frankel did the same thing with dash and gusto, as if it were a game. The results were about the same, and it never turned out to be as easy as Captain Frankel made it look. We needed the abundance of instructors. Jumping a suit, as I have said, is easy on flat ground. Well, the suit jumps just as high and just as easily in the mountains, but it makes a lot of difference when you have to jump up a vertical granite wall between two close-set fir trees and override your jet controls at the last instant. We had 3 major casualties in suit practice in broken country, 2 dead and 1 medical retirement. But that rock wall is even tougher without a suit, tackled with lines and pitons. I didn't really see what use alpine drill was to a cap trooper, but I had learned to keep my mouth shut and try to learn what they shoved at us. I learned it, and it wasn't too hard. If anybody had told me a year earlier that I could go up a solid chunk of rock, as flat and as perpendicular as a blank wall of a building, using only a hammer, some silly little steel pins, and a chunk of clothesline, I would have laughed in his face. I'm a sea-level type. Correction, I was a sea-level type. There had been some changes made. Just how much I had changed, I began to find out. At Camp Sergeant Spooky Smith, we had liberty. To go to town, I mean. Oh, we had liberty after the first month at Camp Curie, too. This meant that, on a Sunday afternoon, if you weren't in the duty platoon, you could check out at the orderly tent and walk just as far away from the camp as you wished, bearing in mind that you had to be back for evening muster. But there was nothing within walking distance, if you don't count jackrabbits. No girls, no theaters, no dance halls, etc. Nevertheless, liberty, even at Camp Curie, was no mean privilege. Sometimes it can be very important indeed to be able to go so far away that you can't see a tent, a sergeant,
nor even the ugly faces of your best friends among the boots. Not have to be on the bounce about anything. Have time to take out your soul and look at it. You could lose that privilege in several degrees. You could be restricted to camp, or you could be restricted to your own company street, which meant that you couldn't go to the library, nor to what was misleadingly called the recreation tent. Mostly some Parcheesi sets and similar wild excitements. Or you could be under close restriction, required to stay in your tent when your presence was not required elsewhere. This last sort didn't mean much in itself, since it was usually added to extra duty so demanding that you didn't have any time in your tent other than for sleep anyhow. It was a decoration added like a cherry on top of a dish of ice cream to notify you and the world that you had pulled not some everyday goof-off, but something unbecoming of a member of the MI, and were thereby unfit to associate with other troopers until you had washed away the stain. But at Camp Spooky, we could go into town. Duty status, conduct status, etc., permitting. Shuttles ran to Vancouver every Sunday morning, right after divine services, which were moved up to 30 minutes after breakfast, and came back again just before supper and again just before taps. The instructors could even spend Saturday night in town, or cop a 3-day pass, duty permitting. I had no more than stepped out of the shuttle, my first pass, than I realized in part that I had changed. Johnny didn't fit any longer. Civilian life, I mean. It all seemed amazingly complex and unbelievably untidy. I'm not running down Vancouver. It's a beautiful city in a lovely setting. The people are charming, and they are used to having the MI in town, and they make a trooper welcome. There is a social center for us downtown, where they have dances for us every week, and see to it that junior hostesses are on hand to dance with, and senior hostesses to make sure that a shy boy, me, to my amazement, but you try a few months without nothing female around but Lady Jackrabbits, gets introduced and has a partner's feet to step on. But I didn't go to the social center that first pass. Mostly I stood around and gawked at beautiful buildings, at display windows filled with all manner of unnecessary things, and not a weapon among them. At all those people running around, or even strolling, doing exactly as they pleased, and no two of them dressed alike. And at girls. Especially at girls. I hadn't realized just how wonderful they were. Look, I've approved of girls from the time I first noticed that the difference was more than just that they dressed differently. So far as I remember, I never did go through that period boys are supposed to go through when they know that girls are different but dislike them. I've always liked girls. But that day I realized that I had long been taking them for granted. Girls are simply wonderful. Just to stand on a corner and watch them going past is delightful. They don't walk, at least not what we do when we walk. I don't know how to describe it, but it's much more complex and utterly delightful. They don't move just their feet. Everything moves and in different directions, and all of it graceful. I might have been standing there yet if a policeman hadn't come by. He sized us up and said, "Howdy, boys, enjoying yourselves?" I quickly read the ribbons on his chest and was impressed. "Yes, sir." "You don't have to say sir to me. Not much to do here. Why don't you go to the hospitality center?" He gave us the address, pointed the direction, and we started that way. Pat Levy, Kitten Smith, and myself. He called after us, "Have a good time, boys. And stay out of trouble." Which was exactly what Sergeant Zim had said to us as we climbed into the shuttle. But we didn't go there. Pat Levy had lived in Seattle when he was a small boy and wanted to take a look at his old hometown. He had money and offered to pay our shuttle fares if we would go with him. I didn't mind, and it was all right.
Shuttles ran every 20 minutes, and our passes were not restricted to Vancouver. Smith decided to go along, too. Seattle wasn't very different from Vancouver, and the girls were just as plentiful. I enjoyed it. But Seattle wasn't quite as used to having MI around in droves, and we picked a poor spot to eat dinner, one where we weren't quite so welcome, a bar-restaurant down by the docks. Now, look, we weren't drinking. Well, Kitten Smith had one beer with his dinner, but he was never anything but friendly and nice. That is how he got his name. The first time we had hand-to-hand combat, Drill Corporal Jones had said to him disgustedly, "A kitten would have hit me harder than that." The nickname stuck. We were the only uniforms in the place. Most of the other customers were merchant marine sailors. Seattle handles an awful lot of surface tonnage. I hadn't known it at the time, but merchant sailors don't like us. Part of it has to do with the fact that their guilds have tried and tried to get their trade classed as equivalent to federal service, without success. But I understand that some of it goes way back in history. Centuries. There were some young fellas there, too, about our age. The right age to serve a term, only they weren't. Long-haired and sloppy and kind of dirty-looking. Well, say about the way I looked, I suppose, before I joined up. Presently, we started noticing that at the table behind us, two of these young twerps and two merchant sailors, to judge by clothes, were passing remarks that were intended for us to overhear. I won't try to repeat them. We didn't say anything. Presently, when the remarks were even more personal and the laughs louder and everybody else in the place was keeping quiet and listening, Kitten whispered to me, "Let's get out of here." I caught Pat Levy's eye. He nodded. We had no score to settle. It was one of those pay-as-you-get-it places. We got up and left. They followed us out. Pat whispered to me, "Watch it." We kept on walking, didn't look back. They charged us. I gave my man a side neck chop as I pivoted and let him fall past me, swung to help my mates. But it was over. 4 in, 4 down. Kitten had handled 2 of them, and Pat sort of wrapped the other one around a lamppost from throwing him a little too hard. Somebody, the proprietor, I guess, must have called the police as soon as we stood up to leave, since they arrived almost at once while we were still standing around, wondering what to do with the meat. 2 policemen. It was that sort of neighborhood. The senior of them wanted us to prefer charges, but none of us was willing. Zim had told us to stay out of trouble. Kitten looked blank and about 15 years old and said, "I guess they stumbled." "So I see," agreed the officer and towed a knife away from the outflung hand of my man. Put it against the curb and broke the blade. "Well, you boys had better run along. Farther uptown." We left. I was glad that neither Pat nor Kitten wanted to make anything of it. It's a mighty serious thing, a civilian assaulting a member of the armed forces. But what the deuce? The books balanced. They jumped us. They got their lumps. All even. But it's a good thing we never go on pass armed and have been trained to disable without killing, because every bit of it happened by reflex. I didn't believe that they would jump us until they already had, and I didn't do any thinking at all until it was over. But that's how I learned for the first time just how much I had changed. We walked back to the station and caught a shuttle to Vancouver. We started practice drops as soon as we moved to Camp Spooky, a platoon at a time, in rotation. A full platoon, that is, a company, would shuttle down to the field north of Walla Walla, go aboard, space, make a drop, go through an exercise, and home on a beacon. A day's work. With 8 companies, that gave us not quite a drop each week. And then it gave us a little more than a drop each week as attrition continued, whereupon the drops got tougher. over mountains, into the Arctic ice, into the Australian desert, and, before we graduated, onto the face of the moon, where your capsule is placed only 100 feet up and explodes as it ejects, and you have to look sharp and land with only your suit. No air, no parachute, and a bad landing can spill your air and kill you. Some of the attrition was from casualties, deaths or injuries, and some of it was just from refusing to enter the capsule, which some did, and that was that. They weren't even chewed out. They were just motioned aside, and that night they were paid off. Even a man who had made several drops might get in the panic and refuse. And the instructors were just gentle with him, treated him the way you do a friend who is ill and won't get well. I never quite refused to enter the capsule, but I certainly learned about the shakes. I always got them. I was scared silly every time. I still am. But you're not a cap trooper unless you drop. They tell a story, probably not true, about a cap trooper who was sightseeing in Paris. He visited Les Invalides, looked down at Napoleon's coffin, and said to a French guard there, "Who's he?" The Frenchman was properly scandalized. "Monsieur does not know? This is the tomb of Napoleon, Napoleon Bonaparte, the greatest soldier who ever lived." The cap trooper thought about it. Then he asked, "So, where were his drops?" It is almost certainly not true, because there is a big sign outside that tells you exactly who Napoleon was. But that is how a cap trooper feels about it. Eventually, we graduated. I can see that I've left out almost everything. Not a word about most of our weapons. Nothing about the time we dropped everything and fought a forest fire for 3 days. No mention of the practice alert that was a real one. Only we didn't know it until it was over. Nor about the day the cook tent blew away. In fact, not any mention of weather, and believe me, weather is important to a doughboy. Rain and mud especially. But though weather is important while it happens, it seems to me to be pretty dull to look back on. You can take descriptions of most any sort of weather out of an almanac and stick them in just anywhere. They'll probably fit. The regiment had started with 2,009 men. We graduated 187. Of the others, 14 were dead, one executed, and his name struck. And the rest resigned, dropped, transferred, medical discharge, etc. Major Malloy made a short speech. We each got a certificate. We passed in review for the last time. And the regiment was disbanded. Its colors to be cased until they would be needed. 3 weeks later, to tell another couple of thousand civilians that they were an outfit, not a mob. I was a trained soldier, entitled to put TP in front of my serial number instead of RP. Big day. The biggest I ever had. 10. The Tree of Liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots. Thomas Jefferson, 1787. That is, I thought I was a trained soldier until I reported to my ship. Any law against having a wrong opinion? I see that I didn't make any mention of how the Terran Federation moved from peace to a state of emergency, and then on into war. I didn't notice it too closely myself. When I enrolled, it was peace, the normal condition. At least so people think. Whoever expects anything else. Then, when I was at Curie, it became a state of emergency. But I still didn't notice it, as what Corporal Bronski thought about my haircut, uniform, combat drill, and kit was much more important, and what Sergeant Zim thought about such matters was overwhelmingly important. In any case, emergency is still peace. Peace is a condition in which no civilian pays any attention to military casualties which do not achieve page 1, lead story prominence. unless that civilian is a close relative of one of the casualties. But if there ever was a time in history when peace meant that there was no fighting going on, I have been unable to find out about it. When I reported to my first outfit, Willie's Wildcats, sometimes known as Company K, 3rd Regiment, 1st MI Division, and shipped with them in the Valley Forge, with that misleading certificate in my kit, the fighting had already been going on for several years. The historians can't seem to settle whether to call this one the 3rd Space War or the 4th, or whether the 1st Interstellar War fits it better. We just call it the Bug War, if we call it anything, which we usually don't. And in any case, the historians date the beginning of war after the time I joined my first outfit and ship. Everything up to then, and still later, were incidents, patrols, or police actions. However, you are just as dead if you buy a farm in an incident as you are if you buy it in a declared war. But to tell the truth, a soldier doesn't notice a war much more than a civilian does, except his own tiny piece of it, and that just on the days it is happening. The rest of the time, he is much more concerned with sack time, the vagaries of sergeants, and the chances of wheedling the cook between meals. However, when Kitten Smith and Al Jenkins and I joined them at Luna Base, each one of Willie's Wildcats had made more than one combat drop. They were soldiers, and we were not. We weren't hazed for it, at least I was not, and the sergeants and corporals were amazingly easy to deal with, after the calculated frightfulness of instructors. It took a little while to discover that this comparatively gentle treatment simply meant that we were nobody, hardly worth chewing out, until we had proved in a drop, a real drop, that we might possibly replace real wildcats who had fought and bought it, and whose bunks we now occupied. Let me tell you how green I was. While the Valley Forge was still at Luna Base, I happened to come across my section leader just as he was about to hit dirt, all slicked up in dress uniform. He was wearing in his left earlobe a rather small earring, a tiny gold skull, beautifully made, and under it, instead of the conventional crossed bones of the ancient Jolly Roger design, was a whole bundle of little gold bones, almost too small to see. Back home, I had always worn earrings and other jewelry when I went out on a date. I had some beautiful ear clips, rubies as big as the end of my little finger, which had belonged to my mother's grandfather. I liked jewelry, and had rather resented being required to leave it all behind when I went to basic. But here was a type of jewelry which was apparently okay to wear with uniform. My ears weren't pierced. My mother didn't approve of it for boys. But I could have the jeweler mounted on a clip, and I still had some money left from pay call at graduation, and was anxious to spend it before it mildewed. Sergeant, where do you get earrings like that one? Pretty neat. He didn't look scornful. He didn't even smile. He just said, "You like it?" "I certainly do." The plain, raw gold pointed up the gold braid and piping of the uniform, even better than gems would have done. I was thinking that a pair would be still handsomer, with just crossbones instead of all that confusion at the bottom. "Does the base PX carry them?" "No. The PX here never sells them," he added. "At least I don't think you'll ever be able to buy one here, I hope. But I'll tell you what, when we reach a place where you can buy one of your own, I'll see to it you know about it. That's a promise." "Thanks. Don't mention it." I saw several of the tiny skulls thereafter, some with more bones, some with fewer. My guess had been correct. This was jewelry permitted with uniform, when on pass at least. Then I got my chance to buy one almost immediately thereafter, and discovered that the prices were unreasonably high for such plain ornaments. It was Operation Bughouse, the first battle of Clendethu in the history books, soon after Buenos Aires was smeared.
It took the loss of B.A. to make the groundhogs realize that anything was going on. Because people who haven't been out don't really believe in other planets. Not down deep where it counts. I know I hadn't, and I'd been space happy since I was a pup. But B.A. really stirred up the civilians and inspired loud screams to bring all our forces home from everywhere, orbit them around the planet practically shoulder to shoulder, and interdict the space Terra occupies. This is silly, of course. You don't win a war by defense, but by attack. No Department of Defense ever won a war. See the histories. But it seems to be a standard civilian reaction to scream for defensive tactics as soon as they do notice a war. Then they want to run the war, like a passenger trying to grab the controls away from the pilot in an emergency. However, nobody asked my opinion at the time, I was told. Quite aside from the impossibility of dragging the troops home, in view of our treaty obligations and what it would do to the colony planets in the Federation and to our allies, we were awfully busy doing something else. To wit, carrying the war to the bugs. I suppose I noticed the destruction of BA much less than most civilians did. We were already a couple of parsecs away under Cherenkov Drive, and the news didn't reach us until we got it from another ship after we came out of Drive. I remember thinking, gosh, that's terrible, and feeling sorry for the one Poteño in the ship. But BA wasn't my home, and Terra was a long way off, and I was very busy, as the attack on Klendathu, the bug's home planet, was mounted immediately after that, and we spent the time in rendezvous strapped in our bunks, doped and unconscious, with the internal gravity field of the Valley Forge off to save power and give greater speed. The loss of Buenos Aires did mean a great deal to me. It changed my life enormously, but this I did not know until many months later. When it came time to drop onto Klendathu, I was assigned to PFC Dutch Bamberger as a supernumerary. He managed to conceal his pleasure at the news, and as soon as the platoon sergeant was out of earshot, he said, "Listen, Boot, you stick close behind me and stay out of my way. You go slowing me down, I'll break your silly neck." I just nodded. I was beginning to realize that this was not a practice drop. Then I had the shakes for a while, and then we were down. Operation Bughouse should have been called Operation Madhouse. Everything went wrong. It had been planned as an all-out move to bring the enemy to their knees, occupy their capital and the key points of their home planet, and end the war. Instead, it darn near lost the war. I am not criticizing General Diens. I don't know whether it's true that he demanded more troops and more support, and allowed himself to be overruled by the Sky Marshal-in-Chief, or not. Nor was it any of my business. Furthermore, I doubt if some of the smart second-guessers know all the facts. What I do know is that the General dropped us and commanded us on the ground, and when the situation became impossible, he personally led the diversionary attack that allowed quite a few of us, including me, to be retrieved, and in doing so, bought his farm. He's radioactive debris on Klendathu, and it's much too late to court-martial him, so why talk about it? I do have one comment to make to any armchair strategist who has never made a drop. Yes, I agree that the Bugs planet, possibly, could have been plastered with H-bombs until it was surfaced with radioactive glass. But would that have won the war? The Bugs are not like us. The pseudo-arachnids aren't even like spiders. They are anthropods who happen to look like a madman's conception of a giant, intelligent spider. But their organization, psychological and economic, is more like that of ants or termites. They are communal entities, the ultimate dictatorship of the hive. Blasting the surface of their planet would have killed soldiers and workers. It would have not have killed the brain cast and the queens. I doubt if anybody can be certain that even a direct hit with a burrowing H-rocket would have killed a queen. We don't know how far down they are, nor am I anxious to find out.
None of the boys who went down those holes came up again. Suppose we did ruin the productive surface of Clindathu. They still would have ships and colonies and